Welcome to Whiskey Cast, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie, and this is episode number 472 for March 29th, 2014. Coming to you this week from Fenton, Michigan. I'll explain why later on. Coming up in a few minutes...
My passionate belief is that to build a serious spirits brand, it always takes you 10 years. There's no such thing as a quick fix. Fast up, fast down. Great brands like Coco Chanel said, fashion goes, but style stays forever. And I think she was the greatest person of all. And I believe that principle applies to liquor.
James Espy has created some of the drinks industry's most iconic brands. Johnny Walker Blue Label, Chivas 18, Bailey's, and Malibu Rum, just to name a few. His latest brands are The Last Drop and himself. He's been building that brand for years and shares his thoughts on brands in his new book, Making Your Mark. More with James Espy later on, and I'll give you a chance to win a signed copy of Making Your Mark. I'll also have the calendar of events, your voice, and more, all on this week's Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey.
Let's start with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Beam shareholders approved Suntory's $16 billion offer for the largest U.S.-based spirits company this week. The deal must still receive final approval from European Union competition regulators, but is expected to close during the final week of April. After that, Suntory will become the world's number three spirits producer, with major stakes in bourbons, Canadian, Irish, and Scotch whiskies, along with its original base in Japanese whiskey. There is a ceasefire of sorts in the Tennessee whiskey war, at least for now. As I reported last week, the Tennessee General Assembly was looking at potential changes to last year's law that created a legal definition for Tennessee whiskey. That law was passed at the request of Jack Daniel's owner, Brown Forman, and the changes were requested by George Dickel owner, Diageo, while the state's craft distillers were split down the middle. Diageo and its side wanted to relax the law's requirements for the use of new oak barrels. And as he threatened to do in our interview with him last week, State Senator Mark Green pulled his bill off the floor and sent the issue to a summer study committee. His attempt to craft a compromise between the two sides failed. That means there won't be any changes in the definition until at least next year. Tennessee distillers still have 2 full years to come into compliance. On the Tennessee distillery front, Chattanooga Whiskey Company is delaying plans to open its new downtown distillery until the spring of 2015. It's the latest delay for the distillery, and a combination of delays in architectural and engineering work on the distillery's end and legal delays on the city's part are getting the blame. The city still has to rework its local zoning ordinances to go along with the state law passed last year that allows for the distillery to be built in Chattanooga. Meanwhile, there's another distillery being built in England. This one's in the Cotswolds region between London and Birmingham and is being underwritten by Daniel Zohr, who spent his career at the hedge fund FX Concepts until it closed down last fall. He's been studying distilling and will be working with Scottish distiller Harry Coburn to produce whiskey and gin starting this fall. And another key figure in the financial services sector has turned to whiskey making. According to eFinancialCareers.com, former Societe Generale executive Eric Cordell has quietly been making whiskey for the last year or more at his small distillery near Saint-Quay-Portrieux on the Brittany coast. Cordell managed the Societe Generale unit that was hit by a rogue trading scandal in 2008 that cost the French bank nearly $6.5 billion and lost his job as a result. Cordell hopes to start selling his single malt later this year, according to the article. His wrongful termination lawsuit against Societe Generale is still pending. Meanwhile, Diageo is facing a lawsuit over the name of its Johnny Walker Explorers Club travel retail range. The Explorers Club, which is headquartered in New York City and has chapters around the world, has filed a lawsuit in New York accusing Diageo of trademark infringement. The club's members range from polar expeditioners to astronauts, and the lawsuit claims the three whiskeys in the Explorers Club series are trading on the club's reputation. The club wants Diageo to either change the name of the series or pay a licensing fee. Diageo has declined to comment on the lawsuit. Ardbeg has unveiled its 2014 limited edition single malt that will be released on May 31st, which is Ardbeg Day at the Isla Festival of Malt and Music and at Ardbeg events around the world. Ora Verdes is derived from the Portuguese words for golden and green, and it not only represents the colors of Ardbeg's whiskey and its bottles, but the colors in Portuguese-speaking Brazil's flag. Of course, the 2014 World Cup will be held in Brazil later this year. The whiskey was matured in ex-bourbon casks with specially toasted heads, using a different toasting level at each end. It'll be available worldwide, including the U.S., for a recommended price of $100 a bottle, again, starting on May 31st. There's no word on how peaty Ora Verdes will be, but there is a new range for the peat lovers among us to explore. Anac is kicking off what it's calling the Peaty Collection, with three new single malts named for the tools that peat cutters use in the bogs. They're peated at between 11 and 15 parts per million of phenols, not heavily peated by Islay standards, but for the Aberdeenshire area of the Highlands, that's a lot stronger than usual. And in another unusual move, the labels for the Peaty Collection whiskies will include the phenol counts for each whiskey. Rudder and Flotter will be available in the UK and other markets, while Tuschkar will debut in Sweden. Turning to Virginia now, Sazerac A. Smith Bowman Distillery is out with the first of its Abraham Bowman Limited Edition bourbons for 2014. The double barrel bourbon was aged just a little more than 7 years, with the final 5 months coming in brand new oak casks. It's bottled at 50% ABV with no chill filtering and will sell for about $70 a bottle. Diageo is jumping into the flavored Scotch whisky market with a honey-infused liqueur based on its J&B blended Scotch. J&B Urban Honey will debut in Spain, and it's bottled at 35% ABV, below the legal standard for whisky. In addition, it'll be clearly labeled as a spirit drink to avoid any consumer confusion or violate the Scotch whisky law. One correction now from last week's episode. In my rundown of Whiskey Magazine's World Whiskies Awards, I inadvertently mentioned last year's Hall of Fame inductees instead of this year's. The Hall of Fame class of 2014 includes retired Irish Distillers Master Distiller Barry Crockett, Glen Grant Distillery Manager Dennis Malcolm, Brickladdy's Jim McEwen, and recently retired Springbank Production Director Frank McCarty. Congratulations to all four men. And sorry for the confusion. You can keep up with the latest whiskey news all week long at whiskeycast.com.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie, introducing Glenmorangie Campanter, the fifth release in the Glenmorangie Private Edition range, a complex maturation in both Burgundy and Côte d'Aron French red wine barriques. Find out more at glenmorangie.com.
This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Highland Park, and this week I'd like to share something with you. I said at the start that this week's episode comes from Fenton, Michigan, and I really wish that there were a whiskey-related reason for that. If you're a long-time listener, you may remember that at the end of December, in episode 458, I mentioned that my mother-in-law, Martha Filburn, had suffered a massive stroke while spending the winter in Arizona. Sadly, she never recovered, and she passed away a few days ago at the age of 66. Earlier today, we said our final goodbyes to her, while worrying that she might have asked for some divine intervention to put some ice under our feet as pallbearers. That's because Marty was a feisty, happy, and smiling woman who loved to pull our chains. I'll give you an example. The day I married her daughter, Christina, many years ago, she thought it would be funny to steal the wedding rings out of my hotel room and hide them, right up until just before the ceremony. That day, I did not see the humor in it, but she taught me and everyone she came into contact with the value of random acts of silliness throughout her life, and she will be missed. Thanks to everyone who posted condolences and good wishes on our Facebook page. The entire family appreciates it. Now, if you have something you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, you can always post it on the Your Voice page at whiskeycast.com or on our Facebook page, or you can email me directly. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com. You can also follow me on Facebook and Twitter @whiskeycast2. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Highland Park.
My name's Daryl Haldane, Global Brand Advocate for Highland Park. Go onto our website at highlandpark.co.uk and upload your photo at Inner Circle to have your face on the walls of the Highland Park Distillery.
Time now for the calendar of events brought to you as always by Laphroaig. Tickets are still available for Whiskey Live New York coming up April 9th. The Göteborg Beer and Whiskey Festival is the weekend of the 10th through the 12th in Göteborg, Sweden. The Hong Kong Malt Whiskey Festival is on the 12th at Crown Wine Cellars on Shuson Hill. Binny's annual World of Whiskies Festival is April 24th in the Chicago suburb of Highland Park, Illinois, followed by Whiskey Fest Chicago on the 25th. The Kentucky Bourbon Festival has its annual Bardstown Sampler on the 26th, and that same day is the Edinburgh Whiskey Fest in Scotland. You'll find more than 250 different whiskey events on the calendar at whiskeycast.com, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
Whiskeycast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Tim Brennan, retired engineering supervisor, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
I've worked with Irish distillers for 40 years. I was born in Middleton and went to school in Middleton and then joined a company in 1971. Traditions in the old distillery were if you were involved in a very dirty job, you then got a half glass of Redbreast. They were the perks in the old distillery. We had one guy there who was particularly fond of his glass of Redbreast. And in order to go to the manager of the warehouse, he would get a really dirty bag of dust and he'd shake it over himself so that he looked so dirty. And he would head off over to the manager and say, "Mr. Daly, here I am. I've had a terrible dirty job for the morning. Look at the cut of me. Any chance of getting a half one?" And he'd duly get his half one, come back, change his clothes, and he was fine again.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
This week on WhiskeyCast In Depth, we'll hear from one of the giants of the Scotch whiskey industry, even though he's never cooked a mash or run a still. James Espy has accomplished a lot over his decades in marketing whiskey and spirits, and he's distilled his knowledge down into a new book, Making Your Mark. It's about building your own personal brand, and building brands is something he knows a lot about. He's one of the few executives to hold senior positions at what was then UDV, now part of Diageo, and Chivas Brothers during its days in the Seagram's Empire. Today, he and his friends own The Last Drop, a boutique whiskey company that just released a 50-year-old blended scotch. Over lunch in New York recently with a group of drinks writers, he shared not only the story of The Last Drop, but some of the highlights of his career. And like most executives, that includes a firing or two along the way.
I was with Chivas and I wanted to launch Chivas 18, one of the few brands I ever researched. I researched it and wanted to launch it, and Edgar Brompton Sr., who died recently, got involved because his son was playing movies. And as a result of that, I said, "I'm launching it." The chairman said, "You're not." I got fired. Well, it was part of the political game anyway. So I lost my job, called in that contract that's in the book. They paid me out for 2 years and said, "What'll I do now?" So then I went plural, which is the buzzword in the UK. I joined a number of boards, Fuller's Brewery, London Pride, AG Bar, Iron Brew Soft Drinks, White and Mackay for 8 years. And then in 2007, I was on holiday in South Africa, and my great friend Peter Fleck, with whom we had created Malibu, has three or four boutique hotels, beautiful hotels, called The Last Word. And when you stay in these hotels, everything you drink is on the house. It's all free. There have been a few people misbehaving, but in the main, people don't. And he said, "Can you get me 50 cases of a blended whiskey called The Last Word?" I said, "No, there's a better idea." And Laura's heard the story 100 times. So anyway, what happened was, I then came back to London, sat with Tom Jager, who was only 82 at the time, in my garden, and we invented a company called The Last Drop Distillers Limited, and the slogan, "Before There Is No More," because we believe there are little parcels hiding there. So then we said, now, another chapter in the book is, be nice to people on the way up, ladies and gentlemen, because with a bit of luck, they may remember you on the way down, okay? You'll see an illustration about it. Mike Keeler, who's the managing director of Morrison Bowmore, was a young accountant when I was his chairman at United Distillers. As a consequence of that, He loved the concept of the last drop, and he said it helped me. So we registered the company, and we also registered the last dram, which I haven't launched yet. Who knows what that will be? So we have the, then we hunted around, and we found in his cellars sleeping three barrels of whiskey, enough for about 1,347 bottles. Then we said, how should we package it? We didn't want to put it in a bling box, because like Lafitte or Latour or Romane Conte, the hero or the heroine, my daughters tell me not to be sexist. I've got two daughters. The heroine is inside the bottle. So we packaged it like this. Everything is packaged. It's an old rum bottle. This is our cognac bottle, same bottle. And on the back is a story of the three geriatrics. And why it's convenient is our dates of birth are there. 1943, 1925, 1943. Ben's 42, he's joined us now, he's the fourth geriatric. Anyway, and it's got a, it's all hand bottled. What we do is we put it in standard glass bottles like that. We then bottle it by hand to order. It's got a driven wine cork and it's dipped in boiling wax. And with every single bottle, box you buy, there is a cork stopper. So when you pull the bottle, you can replace the cork stopper. And then if you want to give a gift to your grandfather or your fiancé, whoever it might be, you may want to drink it with them. And then, so then we said, how are we going to sell it? So that's the package. Each one is individually numbered. And I'll come to the cognac separately. So then we said, how are we going to sell it? And because I'm retired, and I live 400 yards from the centre court at Wimbledon, every time Serena Williams serves, I can hear her grunting. Or pretty close to that. Anyway, Ben and I, old friend, I said, Ben, look, I need some help. So he said he'd like to help me, initially as advisor, and I'm delighted he agreed to join my board of my little baby company. And he led me to Young's Market, led me to Infinium, which led me to this wonderful lady on my right, who's done an outstanding job for us. Couldn't have done it without her. So I came to the United States with this vision, and Laura arranged the PR, and we had some great PR, and we got it going. And the United States, in the beginning, took 350 bottles straight out, and we got going. And so it's always been my number one market. Anyway, then slowly but surely, because it's just me, I roam the world. I'm going to China on the 14th of April, for example. But thank God I'm young. And I roam around. My daughter says, you may come into the business yet, but let's see. So anyway, I found an agent in China. It took me 3 years. I found an agent in Hong Kong. We got into a variety of countries. And in the UK, we work closely with the whiskey shop and a few people. And what we're saying is, anybody can buy a brand of whiskey. Very few people can buy the last drop. And our mantra is old, rare, fresh, exclusive, limited, special. And so our first release, the 1960, in the United States was $2,000. In the UK, it started at £1,000. The last bottles in the UK are, there's a bottle priced now £2,750 in the UK. The United States is gone and it's more than doubled in price. In 5 years, but worse, we launched as the recession started. We started in the recession, the very month of recession. Then we decided cognac. Now, my wife was 60 a few years ago. She's 64 this year. So I thought I wanted a cognac for her 60th birthday because she loves cognac. But I want a real cognac. I want a magical soft cognac. I don't want a brand that pretends it's old. Anyway, we found a little distillery 5 kilometers from the center of cognac run by a lady who had her daughters in the business today who had personally distilled this cognac in 1950, the year of my wife's birth. Now, because of the same laws, I took it out of wood in 1959. So I couldn't call it 60, so I called it 1950. And it's the softest, most delicate, most feminine, most beautiful cognac I've ever tasted. And everything to do is bottled at cask strength, by the way. So if you want a tasting of cognac separately, we can have one later. But at this juncture, I want to... So our first release went out. And then we said, well, how good is it? We went to see Jim Murray. I hadn't met him, by the way, but we sent him samples. And he rated... When we launched the whiskey, he gave it a 96.5 rating and described it as a whiskey that gives you a reason to live. And then the Rob Report wrote nice stories and Anthony Diaz Blue wrote nice stories, thanks to Laura introducing me to him. And basically, it spread around. So it's a voyage of discovery. It's a religious ceremony. So that was the first one. Then came the cognac. We actually sent it to Murray to review. He doesn't do whiskey, cognac, but he said you can use it, and he gave us a 95 rating. And it's soft, it's feminine, and that's 40.9%. And, you know, and we can talk about the cognac separately. So why are we here today? What we did originally, because of the law saying you can't use the minimum age, we took a decision, and Ben was very much involved in that, to put some back into wood, enough for in the region of 400 bottles. So we decided to release 388. Then we said we've got to upgrade the packaging, because as much as we hate bling, we've got to be a bit smarter. So we went and created this leather box, okay? And everything we now do is in this packaging. And it's the same, and obviously this is the new 50-year-old. You can pass this around. That's a dummy of the 50-year-old. And again, the story on the back. And inside there's a little secret drawer here, and in the drawer is a book. And everyone who buys it gets a copy of the book. And in the book is a story, a bit about whiskey and about the founders, but something different, room for tasting notes, ladies and gentlemen. So if you're doing a little taste of this rare whiskey, you can describe it with your friends and go back to it, because this can last you forever. So no one's ever done it before. And there's a little drawer on the side here, which Ben can open. It's quite tough to open. And so you have this book, your tasting notes, and I think I'm talking so much, it's time we had a taste.
Tell me the story about China, because we all know how important China is now to whiskey sales, but you were a pioneer over there back in the day when they were drinking nothing but Baijiu, right?
Correct. Well, I think China has emerged in the last 20-odd years. And what's happened is, I publish an article. I'm happy to send it to you. I publish an article. I write a monthly column for the leading trade publication in India. I published an article on America called America Through the Glass, based on my 30 years working in America. And I published an article on China called 1993 to 2013. It's when I first went to Shanghai and Beijing, wide streets, bicycles and uniforms. Same wide streets now. Extreme pollution, designer cars and fancy shops. Now, what happens in China is capitalism has exploded in China. And if you've got 1.3 billion people in China, they don't have to grow very fast. We're excited in the West that we grow 3%. We think we're recovering from a recession. China's depressed that they're only growing at 6 or 7% now. So put that in context. And you've got all those people. So when I went to China, we also owned Martell Cognac at the time, Chivas, the Seagram family, rather. And we saw a gap. And with a guy called Yoram Rackover, we decided to launch in China. And my passionate belief is that to build a serious spirits brand, it always takes you 10 years. There's no such thing as a quick fix. Fast up, fast down. Great brands like Coco Chanel said, fashion goes, but style stays forever. And I think she was the greatest person of all. And I believe that principle applies to liquor. You know, remember the old, all these Malcolm Hereford's cows 40 years ago, and then breezers and all this. These fast up, fast down die. Great brands are built steadily. So in China, we thought there'd be a future. What happened is people started discovering Scotch and Western tastes. Then this is all compounded by the thing that you may be referring to, Mark, by gift giving. What happened in China, gift giving has become an enormous ritual. Now, the Red Army had a lot to do with this. You were a major. You gave a gift to the colonel. The colonel gave a gift to the brigadier. The brigadier gave a gift to the brigadier general. And the corruption in gift giving at the top was enormous. So what we've read about is the cracking down on gift giving, basically paid for a form of bribery, you might call it. That is completely separate from the very affluent Chinese people you meet. I'm flying to China on a 6-city tour on the 14th of April. I will be appearing at dinners, wearing my kilt. I was lucky enough to be awarded an OB by the Queen and the Queen's birthday honors list last year for services to the whiskey industry. So I'll wear my little OB badge. I don't walk around with this stuff because I don't believe in it. But I wear my little badge in China at dinner. I wear my chairman of the keepers of the Quake at dinner. I wear a kilt. I'll be a dog and pony show. But at that dinner will be very rich young Chinese people. And I reckon there's a chance we could sell 50, 60 bottles on that through 6 dinner parties. So in a sense, there's a lot of rich young, it's the next generation. It's the 40-year-olds where the real money is in China. So ignoring the gift giving, I'm absolutely confident that American companies or European companies investing in China and building brands will do very well. The ones in short-term trouble are the gift giving. So when you read about cognacs, because all that cognac given away to people in the army and to government officials, that's what suffered. But it's a temporary hiccup, ladies and gentlemen. So I'm very confident in China. But Vietnam is taking off. I see a mega future in Vietnam. That's a country where things are exploding. I mean, if you look at Malaysia, you know, you can split the population between the pretend Muslims and the others. You know, again, things are taking off. You go to Macau. It's a much bigger gambling place than Las Vegas today. What are they drinking? So all I'm saying is, we don't even know where it's at. And India has 1.323 billion people. The duty on whiskey, on spirits, is 200% into India. There's more than 60 billion, more than 60 billion cases of whiskey sold in India, but most of it's local. Pseudo scotch, pretend. Only about a billion cases, real scotch. When India opens up, there will not be enough whiskey to service this market. So I'm very confident about the future of scotch. And inter alia, old and rare things. People who invest in fine wine should be investing in old whiskey. Or old bourbon, if you can get it. Because that's the wave of the future. So, yeah, China's enormous and will be. It's just a temporary little mini hiccup.
Well, what does that mean for the rest of us who can't afford the prices that whiskies are reaching these days?
Well, let me put it differently. I am not a snob. I may sell the most expensive. In my home, I drink whatever I feel like. My favorite whiskey might be a Chivas Regal or a Black Label, but most of the time I drink a standard blend. I drink Bacardi. You know, there's no need to be a snob. I'm speaking in an informal sense. It's nice to have some. There's no reason why quality spirit should be expensive. The United States is not too expensive. If you have a nice vodka, I mean, vodka's, you're all going to get a copy of the book. You read, there's a whole story about vodka in there. End of the day, Smirnoff used to be a $10 brand. Along came Absolut, was a $20 brand. Along came Grey Goose, was a $30 brand. Now we got $40 and $50, $60. Is that rational? No, it's consumers buying with their eyes. Here's the parallel. I'm going to give everyone around this table a brand new motor car after lunch. They'll be outside waiting for you. Now you've got a choice. I'm going to give you a BMW with a Chevrolet engine. Or a Chevrolet with a BMW engine. Which one are you going to take? You all take the BMW because there's imagery. And that's the principle of buying vodka. So all I'm saying is there are occasions when it's very nice. But I go into restaurants and have the house wine often. You don't have to. I don't believe in my own value system. And my father was a police officer in the bush years ago. So I've never forgotten where I come from. And the problem with success in the banking world is people confuse money with status. It doesn't impress me. I'm delighted there are people who genuinely want to buy the quality things, collectors. But for you and us around the table who work hard for what we do, enjoy the standard brands, be selective, select your wine, hunt around, don't be impressed. I shouldn't be saying that when I'm selling this stuff, but you know what I mean. The principle is fundamental. Enjoy the very best if you're able to have it, but don't get carried away and think it's important. Just appreciate it, that it's unique, it's special. For the most thing, most life, you know, I go home, I have spaghetti bolognese or cheese on toast, I'm quite happy. I'm not sitting here and having caviar, which I don't eat anyway much. The principle applies.
So how'd you come up with the idea for The Keepers?
In 1982, I became the chief executive of IDV UK, which is rather like, is Diageo UK. And as a consequence, I was in charge of a chain of stores called Peter Dominic. We had 500 stores, we bought a lot of wine. And the chairman of Grand Med asked me to go to Burgundy with him. I didn't understand why, but I then discovered that Grand Med had separately an own little wine company called Geisweiler, G-I-S-W-E-I-L-E-R, a Burgundy house, but we weren't buying much wine from them. Basically, he invited me to become a Chevalier de Tastevin of Burgundy, and I had a wonderful weekend, and I was very impressed by this amazing ceremony. I couldn't understand how it just happened. It was a ceremony, and it was just a wonderful event, but I spoke to people, and I found that virtually anyone could be a Chevalier. It was a very clever piece of brilliant marketing. So I thought, we have this 500-year-old venerable industry. Why don't we truly establish something to honor people? Call it a Scotch whiskey knighthood, if you like. So as a consequence of that, I wrote a little plan in my mind. And when I joined United Distillers in 1986, I proposed that we should create the society. But I didn't want distillers to dominate, because we're used to being the distillers company being very domineering. So I went and sold it to the industry, to the five majors. At that stage, the five majors were Famous Grouse, which is an independent company called Highland Distillers. There was obviously United Distillers. There was IDV / J&B. There was Ballantine's, part of Allied. And there was Seagram with Shivers. And there were the minor companies. But I sold it to the five majors, and I created a concept called the Order of the Malt, which we then changed to the Keepers of the Quaigh, the Quaigh being, of course, the Scottish drinking vessel. And I called the first meeting in my office, and the first four people arrived. I pointed them to their positions. The chairman of Famous Grouse, I made him the treasurer, because he was a financial man. The man from Allied, I made him a good friend of mine, Mark Butterworth, the vice chairman. The secretary was a PR man inside United Cellars called Gordon McIntosh, and he loved the concept, so he was in the meeting as secretary. The last person to arrive, Segan weren't part of it at that stage because Ivan Straker, the late Ivan Straker, didn't support it, but Ed MacDonald strongly did, so tacitly they were there. And the last person to arrive at the meeting was James Brooksner, so I put him at the head of the table and said, right, you're the new chairman. And I kind of would choreograph it. And then we got a chap called Alistair McIntosh who advises protocol in Scotland. We decided to create something totally British and special because Britain is great at tradition and history and heritage. So we hunted around for a place. We found Blair Castle, which, as you know, became our spiritual home. We designed a ceremony. We created a kilt embracing all the colours of whiskey, water, the soil, the peat. And that's why the keeper's kilt is of the colour it is. But what I was dogmatic about is the keepers must only be for people who have made a solid contribution to this industry. And even if you're the new chief executive, I don't care. If you haven't done 5 years, you don't qualify. Rank hath no privilege. Secondly, we wanted an egalitarian induction. In other words, it's done alphabetically. And, you know, the first Japanese was a guy called Noritomo. The second one was Saji. Saji wanted to be the first Japanese on that. I said, sorry, N comes for S. That's the way it is. And they accepted it with good grace. When you sit at a keeper's table, you don't sit at your own whiskey table. It's just a whiskey table. And anyway, we created the ceremony, and we vowed that we'd only have two banquets a year at Blair Castle, approximately 80 people. I got Glen Eagles to do the initial catering, because I knew them very well, and they were supportive of it. And we kind of created on the hoof. But what we said is you cannot be a keeper unless you made a contribution for a minimum of 5 years. We also introduced life membership after a few years because we didn't want people trying to propose somebody for commercial gain and then that person wonders why they're not paying their subscriptions. So when you propose a keeper, it's a life membership. And Gordon McIntosh left to run a full-time office, and I went to the first 25 banquets just behind the scenes as a member of the committee, and then I became chairman my last 3-4 years. And we, you know, it just grew. We got the lords and ladies of Scotland to support us, so all the nobility of Scotland. And Lord Elgin was an amazing man, an amazing voice. He'd come and sing, as you know, Mark, and his son's taken over. And it just evolved. So the five founding members underwrote everything, any cost. And then everyone else became associate members at a fixed price of about £5,000 a year. So everyone was very happy. But it's completely egalitarian. And, you know, and the banquets are all sold out. And I've been privileged, to have had lunch with Ronald Reagan here in New York, persuaded him to come and be our speaker. I was introduced to him by Forbes magazine when he's retired, and he was brilliant. We've had Prince Charles as speaker, I've had F.W. de Klerk from South Africa, and I had a game of golf with him the day before. But forgetting all that, we've had Jackie Stewart, we've had people from all over the world, and they can't become keepers. They can only be honorary keepers. We're absolutely strict. So we have a society of about 2,000 keepers today. It's flourishing in about 85 countries. And, you know, I've seen people shaking when they become keepers. Multi-millionaires shaking when you have this big $20,000 quech. You put your hand on the quech and you say, will you uphold the aims and honors of the keepers of the quech? You say, I will, and they're shaking. And I've known people who, it's like a Scotch whiskey knighthood to some, which is quite exciting. I've seen an obituary column in a British newspaper where it said, whatever his name was, 17th member of the keepers. And, you know, you see business cards all over the place. Keeper of the quake, master of the quake. Because once you've done 10 years as a keeper, you are then eligible to be considered to become a master. So of all the brands I've been involved with, is one I'm proudest of, because it's not for profit. It's for the industry that I love, you love and I love. And that's the heritage. And, in fact, I'm currently writing the history of the keepers as it happens, privately, which will be kept in the archives of the keepers. And I'm quite sure that the keepers had much to do with me receiving that honour from the Queen last year. So in a sense, you know, it's just the most wonderful, everything about it is wonderful, and I love it.
So which is more valuable to you? Which one do you prize more, the OBE or the keepers?
No, I prize the OBE. It's not a contest because the OBE is for services to the Scotch whisky industry.
I had to ask.
Everything one has to do. But as of the brands I've invented or launched, I'm proudest of the keepers. I'm proud of Blue Label. I'm proud of Malibu. I'm proud of being involved in Bailey's. I'm very proud of The Last Drop. But the keepers is for the industry. And that is the important thing. And I think we should be thinking much more long term. There's far too much short term greed. You know, in our first 25, 30 years, we didn't even get bonuses. But we didn't care. Because what a lovely industry. I'd rather be discussing liquor than toilet rolls or chairs or buckets. I mean, we're in a very exciting industry. And I've had the privilege going to Buckingham Palace, meeting these famous people, but being in the roughest, toughest bars in the world, seeing the most unspeakable things happen. I can't moralize. That's what happens with liquor. It permeates every strata of society. And what a lovely industry.
Tell me the story of Blue Label, because it wasn't originally called Blue Label when you came up with it along with Tom Jago, right?
We originally called it Johnny Walker Oldest. What I wanted was a halo brand. And I asked Tom to find me the oldest whiskey in great condition he could find at the time. I wanted a halo brand to support Black Label. And I'm a great believer in pulling, you know, image building it as part of the a kind of a ladder effect, a triangular ladder. And so we found a barrel of 6-year-old, which we blended a little bit with predominantly 15-year-old. It was a 50, but it was a brilliant blend. And we found, Tom created a bottle as you would have imagined it to be 100 years ago. And we called it Johnny Walker Oldest. And we launched it carefully, priced it appropriately, as it is today, and got it on Concord, got it all over the place. And it took off. And the only thing that changed is when I left the company and became the president of Shivers Brothers, my main brand was Royal Salute, which I knew was 21. Now, Blue Label is an outstanding whiskey, and I'm not sure what age it is today, but that's not the point. We found there was a new man at United Distillers who had come from McKinsey, nothing to do with the heritage of the industry, and he was pushing in nightclubs in Taiwan. Johnny Walker, older, 60 years of age, Royal Salute 21. That's ethically and morally incorrect. So we got the law changed, and the law says today you can only mention the youngest age of any whiskey in a blend. So they changed the name from Johnny Walker Oldest to Blue Label. And it's a phenomenal brand. I'm very proud of it. Doing brilliantly. And now there are other ones, but they don't have ages. It's King George or whatever it might be. Great brand. Johnny Walker's arguably the greatest brand in the industry. But age is very finite. And that's why, you know, I sell the last drop. It's a defined age. Therefore, it's controlled. I can't extend it. I can only sell what they've got. But when you don't see an age statement on a cognac or a whiskey, you know it's flexible because they blend. They blend according to a quality standard, but they mix ages in terms of what's available and what makes sense.
So where do you stand on the whole age statement issue, since you're using it for last drop, but we're seeing more distillers and your colleagues in the industry coming out with whiskeys that carry no age statement to make it easier for them to get it to market?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to argue with it. All I'm saying is there's room for both. But if you want the genuine item with real pedigree, it's going to have an age statement, but there's very little about. No, after all, I mean, and also you think of problems, whether it's proof strength problems. Look at the problems Maker's Mark had and where they backtracked. Thank God they backtracked, and it's in my book. I'm pleased they did. But if you think about it in context, if you want to sell volume, and ultimately you've got to make profits, of course you want to be as flexible as you can. So providing your standards are met. After all, there are minimum standards for whiskey. You can't call a whiskey until it's been in the barrel for at least 3 years. You know, there are different standards for bourbon, there are different standards for rye. So I'm not here to define which one's better or the other. I'm just saying, you know, an age doesn't always mean better, by the way. Things go off too. Whether it's a wine, all you know is, you know, you get vintage and you get non-vintage. I drink a lot of non-vintage champagne. I love it. I don't necessarily think the vintage champagne's better, but every now and again, there's a superb one that's better. And so what, in my case, when we launched this cognac of ours, we actually tasted 47s. They weren't as good as the 50. We taste them all blind. So, you know, I just think, for many people, psychologically, age is an insurance statement. It's a reference of fact. It is old. Now, when we get very old, we're probably not too attractive. That's life. But with liquid, it's different.
James Espy's new book is called Making Your Mark, and it's available at most online booksellers, including the Whiskey Cast bookstore, powered by Amazon.com. I've read it, and with graduation season coming up in a few weeks, personally, I think it's a great gift for any young graduate just entering the real world. Now, James generously gave me a signed copy to give away to a WhiskeyCast community member, and if you've registered as a member at WhiskeyCast.com, you're automatically in the running. If you haven't, sign up for free between now and April 15th, and I'll pick a winner at random from our registered members. Now, here's where I would normally start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with my tasting notes for the Last Drop 50-year-old, but there's a hitch. Remember, I'm in Michigan this weekend, and I left my tasting journal behind in the charming yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. You get the idea. What I can tell you from memory is that it's an outstanding whiskey, and I scored it 97 points. But you'll have to check WhiskeyCast.com for my actual notes on the Last Drop 50-year-old. Now that's also where you'll find my searchable tasting notes for more than 1,100 different whiskeys, along with links for WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings episodes, the latest whiskey news, and the calendar of events.
the Your Voice page, where you can share your comments and questions, and much more, including a complete archive of past episodes. You can also follow me on Facebook and Twitter at WhiskeyCast, and my email address for your questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2014, and comes to you this week from Fenton, Michigan. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.